7 p.m. inside the atrium at 60 Wall Street. All listeners were invited. I repeat, the WBAI Community Advisory Board will meet on Sunday, August 19th at 1 p.m. inside the atrium at 60 Wall Street. All listeners are invited to attend.
What's it like growing up in a family where your parents are showbiz royalty? And what's it like growing up in two very different cultures? We'll find out Saturday morning on Earth Mom Radio when we speak with artist Alexander Newley, son of actress Joan Collins and the multi-talented singer, composer, actor Anthony Newley. That's Earth Mom Radio, Saturday morning, 6 a.m. See you there.
Little bird, little traveler, I don't understand.
On Sunday, August 19th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents multi-dimensional bassist and composer Jamaluddin Tukuma. Join us as we discuss parts of Jamaluddin Tukuma's career and discuss what's happening in the red carpet room. That's Sunday, August 19th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Stand with Mumia as he has stood up for us in Philadelphia, in front of the Common Pleas Courthouse on 13th and Filbert Street, Thursday, August 30th at 8 a.m. Join the mobilization for Mumia in the streets and courthouse as we demand all files be released. For details about Mumia's wrongful conviction and round-trip transportation, call the Free Mumia Coalition hotline number at 212-330-8029 or write to info@freemumia.com. Remember, when we fight, we win.
The people-to-people relationships are open and strong, and people are seeking those the strengthening of those ties, and we have a duty to take the steps that are necessary in order to strengthen them.
Ofia Wangaza is founding director of the Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination and member of the Black Alliance for Peace.
All of the countries that the United States has attacked have been people-centered, people-oriented, whether you're talking about Iraq without getting into the internal politics, or you're talking about Libya, or you're talking about Venezuela. It is a way to defeat the emergence of socialism and a people-centered economy.
This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Indeed it is. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. It's Wednesday evening, 8 o'clock, time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening. Joined tonight by Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Kyle.
Hey, what's happening?
And Voltaire.
Hey.
Welcome back from Vegas.
Thank you.
We'll talk about some of the things that went on out there in the hour ahead. And we'll be taking phone calls in just a little bit, hopefully. So, anybody else lose their security clearance today? It's not a surprise. I mean, you know, I saw it coming. But, just don't criticize, and you'll be all right. That's what we learn.
I wish he lost his clearance for as punishment for his torturing people and being, instead of, like, for going against president.
But you can't lose your clearance for torturing people. That's the job. When you're head of intelligence, that's
the job isn't to torture people.
Well, I mean, it's kind of been understood over the past few years.
It's hard to root for him, but in this scenario.
Is. Exactly.
Yeah. I hear that. I fully hear that.
And,
yeah.
You know, if you close yourself off to intelligence leaders, evil or good, you're kind of you're driving without your headlights on. And that's probably not a good idea. Speaking of driving without headlights on. Anybody else notice a problem with, well, I guess you guys didn't notice, you don't drive, but Waze, boy, there's something up with Waze today. I'm not really sure how it is installed on my phone. We use Waze occasionally just to see. Sometimes it takes us down the back streets of Brooklyn, to save traffic. How many times have we gone through, what's that? What's
Bold-faced liar. We are so dependent. We can't not navigate without it.
No,
it's
we totally
like
can.
It's a permanent part of our, no, I'm just kidding.
The BQE is fairly, easy to,
you
know, it's easy
but when
to
you
navigate.
Need it
sometimes,
most.
What's that industrial area we cut through sometimes, which is really awesome? Not Elmhurst. I'm trying to think of the name. It's the place.
It'll come to us.
Yeah, it'll come. Yeah, if you're in Queens, you know what we're talking about.
We've often
Queens and Brooklyn. Sometimes it guides us down these one-way streets, and it's a lot of fun.
It can be fun, yes.
Today, though, something was different. First of all, there's all these network issues. Whenever I try to get bearings, it can't find the network. You're in the middle of a city, and you can't find the network. It doesn't make any sense. Eventually, though, it found the network. Except instead of the usual clip British accent woman that we have giving us directions, it turned into this really rough-sounding male voice, which scared the crap out of me, but only for one sentence. And then it went back to her. And then something else happened where apparently a comma has been redefined as 10 seconds because she'll say things like, in 300 meters, and then pause 10 seconds and then tell you what to do, except you've already passed it by that point. So something weird's going on with that. I don't know if it's inside my own phone or if it's something network-wise, but...
Yeah, there's lots of ways to look at it. It could be the way the operating system on the phone itself is working with the network or being handed off in the progress of using those kinds of applications. And I think we probably do to test some other ones, compare, get some perspective on how these sort of online ones that are run over the network versus... standalone ones that you sort of program in advance and then it's sort of already got the maps.
Yeah,
it seems like this is having communication difficulty with whatever service is hosting it.
I like Waze. I like Waze because it's always changing and, it'll tell you about traffic and route you around. What I don't understand about Waze is they want you to be social. They want you to be chatting with people while you're driving. And I don't know how you're supposed to do that safely. I also don't even know how you're supposed to report things safely while you're driving. People are constantly doing it. I mean, you know, there's one cop sitting on the side of the road, and all of a sudden there's 50 people that have reported him, which is kind of cool, but I don't know how to do that safely, you know, without swerving.
Yeah, there's invaluable information there in that social aspect because those things can be significant. If someone sees something that fell off a truck or whatever the obstruction in the roadway is, getting that information so quickly, I think it would be very hard to get that from like an AM radio or another traffic news source, even if they're flying above you or whatever in their news copter.
Right, right. No, an AM radio is not going to tell you there's a car, you know, on the shoulder ahead or there's an animal on the road, which is the kind of thing that Waze can do. But it is weird having that on your phone, not exactly knowing how it works. And, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, my phone in the middle of Waze, in fact, went black. And did an update. Now, usually, you know, phones are supposed to ask you, do you want to do an update now? Do you want to do an update at all? Didn't get that. It just did it. And when it did it, it screwed up all my settings. It changed the font on the clock. It did all kinds of things I didn't want it to do. And privacy settings, gone. You know, just switch back to show me, you know, everything about you. really resented that.
It's a lot of the antithesis of, I think, how the Apple system works. I'm not pushing one or the other, but I am saying that this is a distinction in how switching from device to device is managed and upgrading and that kind of thing. You would ideally want those settings. You don't want new fonts or new sounds in your operating system. So it is an undesirable, I think, side effect of just how I think cumbersome mm-hmm. the Android updating method. Although it's gotten better, but I would also blame a little bit T-Mobile and so in how they're implementing that overall, sort of from a general perspective. But there's certainly a lot of room for improving the way these things work. It just seems to me that the manufacturer and the mobile provider would be very interested in service and the reliability of sort of the basics of the operating system instead of loading it up with all this extra stuff and doing these really cumbersome and lousy, poorly implemented updates. That's not in the interest of providing the service.
I've noticed a trend in operating systems and phones to sort of leave the consumer behind. You don't matter as much. We have to do this. Deal with it.
And everyone's doing it. We'll force it.
It's like the sysadmin who would say, we're rebooting the system now, not giving you any warning whatsoever. No choice. You lose your files, whatever. That's just the way it goes. So, you know, I have this happening with the phone where I lose settings in inconvenience without any permissions being asked. And, of course, all my settings are reverted back to what they want them to be. And features are added that I didn't ask for, and features are taken away that I needed. And when you talk to people about this, well, that's just the way it is. It's not the phone you bought. No, it's now a different kind of phone, and you just have to adjust. Same thing with operating systems on computers. Like Windows 10 is a perfect example of that.
Ooh, it's prime suspect. Yeah, it does not function nearly the way you might expect coming from, say, a previous version of their own operating system,
right,
like XP or 7 or 8. All of a sudden, 10 starts doing this stuff where it's basically taking a lot of the power out of the administrator and doing things that are completely unexpected and very disruptive.
Well, through no fault of my own, I have a machine that runs Windows 10, all right? And I have to tell you, it is the biggest pain in the ass because it just reboots on its own. If you're in the middle of something because it decides it wants to do that. Okay, yeah, you can set it so it doesn't reboot on its own, so it nags you. You can't ever make it not reboot, but you can have it say, okay, I'll do this tomorrow, and then nag you the next day, et cetera, et cetera. Except sometimes it just does it anyway. And that is the trend that we're seeing with operating systems where, like I said, the consumer is left behind. You don't get a say. And we're going to have to reboot every now and then. I've used machines for a year at a time without rebooting them, having projects open, all kinds of things like that. That's how I work. But apparently that's something that's not going to be considered for operating systems of the future. And what you're going to see more of, too, are just the equivalent of dumb terminals where everything is in the cloud.
Yeah,
every damn thing is in the cloud and you don't have control. I mean, we see that with software.
Software as a service is a trend that is found its way into operating systems and was very convenient for smartphones in general, but it is a big part of graphic design software,
something like Avid.
You know, Adobe,
How has that changed over the years, Avid?
You used to be able
to just buy it, right?
It's absolutely changed a whole lot. And this is the same with Photoshop, which thankfully has a really healthy variety of alternatives right now. But video software in general was something that you owned. You had a copy of it. And you were coaxed and encouraged, hey, come along to the next version. We'll add these features
but
and we'll shore
keep,
it up.
You can keep your old version
it's
if you want.
It's your choice. But this has been slowly taken away from something that the consumer... And in an effort to make it sort of easier and more approachable to their consumer base, but also for their own management, it's much easier for them to just push stuff to people and force them through and have everybody come along with you.
And now you pay a monthly fee and you're kind of locked in. And I think the same thing is going to happen on almost everything that we use. You won't actually own it. You won't actually control it. You'll just have a virtual presence someplace.
Well, and with production software in particular, the companies that use that have a massive account most of the time with these organizations, and they're willing to buy all sorts of licenses and have it managed that way. And it's really not at all a problem to budget. You know, they're gonna buy like $100,000 worth of Apple products and outfit their newsroom or whatever it is. But the smaller producers, the people who are making and innovating and doing a lot with these technologies that have been so democratized, they're kind of in the lurch because they can't possibly wield this and pay like $1,200 a year or $2,200 a year, whatever the commercial rate is, because you're not a qualified educational institution and so on. You're left to basically only use and sort of own with a serial or other kind of software authentication key, but no way can you afford to climb onto their new model of hosting it as a service. And for whatever reason, you know, whatever their rationale is, it's your only option because everything else is older or depreciated.
Yeah, with all these companies like Microsoft trying to force you to buy their cloud products, Apple's doing it too.
Microsoft 365 or something.
Yeah, yeah, and Apple's been doing it too with like the purposely low storage they provide to make you buy their cloud stuff. It makes it more important to be able to like run your own stuff. And on the Linux side of things, there's been a lot of progress made in going the opposite direction, where Windows is requiring you to install their OS updates whenever.
Right.
With Ubuntu in the newest version, they have, you can live patch new kernel updates without having to restart your computer.
So, yeah, the capability is certainly there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it turns out that the companies that make this software really like money. And they like taking more of it from you than they're perhaps entitled to. They like being able to automatically get more money from you on a regular basis because, you know, they could sell you something in a box that will do what you want and you just take it home and do it. But if they sell you a membership in something else that you need them for, that you need them to continue, that you need to continue using them for, that's a whole other thing. And, of course, they're going to go that way.
Well, there's also the issue of privacy. When you run your own computer system, you control your files. You control what you make public and what you don't. You take the responsibility for that, whether you keep a backup or not. That's really something that is up to you. When you're in the cloud, you kind of lose that. Now, I saw this story the other day. You know, the stories you see virtually every day of some teacher someplace who was caught with hundreds of images of child pornography on their computer. Okay, here's another one of those. And this particular case, I just saw this paragraph, and it intrigued me. This guy started uploading hundreds of images, as I said, of child pornography to the storage feature of his Google account in April, federal prosecutors said in court papers. Google officials, following both federal law and the company's policies, suspended the teacher's account and notified law enforcement. Now, you know, if you go over to Google Drive and you ask them the question, is Google Drive secure? They say when you upload files to Google Drive, they are stored in secure data centers. If your computer, phone, or tablet is lost or broken, you can still access your files from other devices. Your files are private unless you share them. Well, I think this guy currently in jail someplace would disagree with that. And, you know, here's the problem. When it's dealing with somebody who's either in prison or a suspect in child pornography or even somebody in the military, regular people tend not to care as much because, well, they knew what they were getting into or they deserve it or something like that. But this is very, very relevant to everybody because we need to know if you upload something to a service that says it's private and then you upload the wrong image and all of a sudden the cops are at your door, obviously it's not private. Obviously, it's being scanned and looked at and analyzed. And believe me, it can get a lot more insidious than illegal images. This can be about words. This can be about conspiracies, about who you associate with. All that information, no longer private. Rob?
And maybe a sexual predator isn't the best use case to hold up, but we saw it happen with a few years ago when there was that massive leak of private images of celebrities because they were using iCloud, something which just came with their phone, and they just used it without thinking that this was something that was open to other people who were able to wrangle their way in, download images
but
that
But in that case, didn't somebody hack their password at least to get the images? This is Google saying, hey, guys, we got something here. Go get this guy. You know, and we may say, okay, that's the right thing. They should do that. But we don't know they're doing that until something like this happens. And that's kind of the red flag that, you know, I see being waved here.
That's true. And there's an old saying in the IT world, which is like, there's no such thing as the cloud. There's just other people's computers. Computers you don't control.
Yeah. And I think their enforcement and policing of that content, is, something that would quell creativity in a lot of ways. And, you know, you say you have a documentary or something that's going to release, expose a corporate malfeasance, some controversial issue. If some algorithm or some unknown entity at an organization that's hosting some of the materials that you're using to produce that content, if they're looking at it or somehow it's being exfiltrated in advance, how would you be able to have any kind of element of surprise or release that? You know, were the right interests involved, your entire story or something you could be breaking to the public that is in the public interest is then, you know, collapses because of this kind of industrial espionage or otherwise, you know, disruptive policing of something that you, in your opinion, feel is important to people and that they should be able to judge.
And it's not just your private data like that. There are people nowadays whose entire email presence is wrapped up in a Gmail account, which is run by Google, which is a company that sells advertising for a living.
You say this like it's unusual. That's almost everybody I know is completely wrapped up in Google.
It is. And this is a company that is giving you free stuff that's easy to use and convenient and all that. But they're using this information that they gather about you through your use of the product to fuel what they actually do for a living, which is sell you things, which is sell other people things about you, your info.
Rob,
things
not
like
just
that.
Sell you. Things sell you.
Yes.
They are selling you to various companies.
Yes, and you become the product
exactly,
by using these.
Exactly. Voltaire.
Back to Kyle's point, it runs like a lot of these systems are basically taking hashes of your files you upload. And we were talking about a few weeks ago with the EU policy of like the mandatory filters, Article 17. Those things can't. Algorithms can't decide whether or not something is fair use, but they can still like prevent you from sharing a link to a video file, say, if you're a documentarian and you're doing fair use with that. It's like they can't determine that.
There's a lot in there, and if you measure and you sort of cut out stuff with that kind of a coarse that level of granularity, you really remove a lot of possibility when it comes to imagery or content and so on. And basically, these entities who are acting as hard drives ought not to be ought not to have a say in necessarily what the content of what you're producing is. It's never been the case, but now. In giving them that stuff, you have the possibility. You're open to the possibility of it. But and algorithms, yeah, they may be looking for very narrow things. And I described it, I think that's a very coarse, cumbersome way in some ways censor the ability of people to express themselves. You need humans involved in that, and you need to give people the opportunity to produce and express themselves.
So before we move on, what's the solution? Because you know we can tell people, yeah, this is a problem. You're going to be compromised. You're going to lose all your privacy if you keep things in the cloud. But obviously, people can't all run their own mail servers. They can't all run their own Unix systems. What is it that we should suggest people do instead of buying into this, Voltaire?
Collective political action. So, like demanding tougher like privacy laws and contracting the surveillance state.
Okay, well, demanding things is great, but it doesn't always work right away. It takes a long. What can you do next week that will make you more secure? Rob?
I think it's just a way of looking at the data that you're using and that you're moving around and being cognizant, and a lot of people are not, being cognizant that photo you're taking and putting up on your, you know, cloud account here or there is something that is being placed on a network that is hooked up to basically the entire world. And
We're not advising child pornography connoisseurs to do that. You guys continue to use the cloud all you want. That's how they keep this kind of advice from reaching people, because, well, we have to protect everybody from the really evil people out there. And if you don't go along with it, you're enabling those people. And that's something we have to detach ourselves from, because that's not the case at all.
No, I want to reiterate. That's my point, is that it's all the things that get swept up in this hysteria. The fear, the hysteria is the bait. but it is not actually the addressing the issue.
Right. Now, if you know that, you know, your files, your email, whatever, are not as private as you want them to be, at least you know that. And maybe that's okay with you. But I just don't want people to be surprised when they think that they're doing something that's secure and it's absolutely not secure. At least know that. And then, you know, once you know that, if it's not okay with you, then you can look into other solutions. Maybe a service that has a better reputation. Maybe you learn some basic computer skills and do things locally. The important thing is to be educated and to know if you're living in security or living in insecurity.
Yeah, it really depends on your threat model. If your threat model, if you're like a dissident or a journalist, say your threat model might be the surveillance state. Whereas if you're like just more average person without technical skills, I think you're actually better off with Google than like with locally hosted things, because like then you like a lot of people in real life their major threat model is about like an abusive partner or something, well, and if they have local access to your files, then that's dangerous.
Uh-huh. I like to think the average person is a dissident right now, but maybe that's just a pipe dream. But I think, you know, we all benefit from education, from learning how these things actually are working.
Yeah, and think about creative ways to do this stuff. You don't have to do, I guess, necessarily what everyone sort of does as a solution. And there are a myriad of alternatives and pieces of alternatives that could be part of the whole that is a much better solution or more attractive solution. So definitely supporting cool projects that are related to storage or they're related to video editing, whatever it is. You know, there are bits and pieces of that are non-commercial, and you know, leveraging those things as much as possible against the enormous for-profit versions is always a good source of I guess dissent and activity, and it pushes you in a lot further away from only having those alternatives that are hosted for you and so convenient.
In a kind of related story to both my phone and this, it turns out that Google is tracking your movements whether or not you tell it to track your movements. According to the Associated Press, Google wants to know where you go so badly that it records your movements even when you explicitly tell it not to. An Associated Press investigation found that many Google services on Android devices and iPhones store your location data even if you've used a privacy setting that says it will prevent Google from doing so. Computer science researchers at Princeton confirmed these findings at the AEP's request. And for the most part, Google is upfront about asking permission to use your location information. An app like Google Maps will remind you to allow access to location if you use it for navigating. If you agree to let it record your location over time, Google Maps will display that history for you in a timeline that maps out your daily movements. Who wouldn't want that? Storing your minute-by-minute travels carries all kinds of privacy risks and has been used by police to determine the location of suspects. Imagine that. Such as a warrant that police in Raleigh, North Carolina served on Google last year to find devices near a murder scene. So the company lets you pause a setting called location history in case you need to commit a murder. You pause it there and then resume it later. I don't know what exactly.
It tells them exactly what range of time to look on other sources to find out where you were.
Right, right. Google says that will prevent the company from remembering where you've been. Google's support page on the subject states you can turn off location history at any time. With location history off, the places you go are no longer stored. But that is not true. Even with location history paused, some Google apps automatically store timestamp location data without asking. It's possible, according to this article, although laborious, to delete it. You have to jump through all kinds of hoops. Now, for example, Google stores a snapshot of where you are when you merely open its Maps app. Automatic daily weather updates on Android phones pinpoint roughly where you are. For some reason, my phone thinks I'm in Connecticut now. I don't know why, but I love it. I love when it gets things wrong. Some searches that have nothing to do with location, like chocolate chip cookies or kids' science kits, pinpoint your precise latitude and longitude, accurate to the square foot, and save it to your Google account. The privacy issue affects some 2 billion users of devices that run Google's Android operating software, and hundreds of millions of worldwide iPhone users who rely on Google for maps or search. Now, Storing location data in violation of a user's preferences is wrong, said Jonathan Meyer, a Princeton computer scientist and former chief technologist for the FCC's Enforcement Bureau. A researcher from his lab confirmed the AP's findings on multiple Android devices. The AP conducted its own test on several iPhones that found the same behavior. If you're going to allow users to turn off something called location history, then all the places where you maintain location history should be turned off, Meyer said. That seems like a pretty straightforward position to have. Google counters that it's being perfectly clear. There are a number of different ways that Google may use location to improve people's experience, including location history, web and app activity, and through device-level location services, said a Google spokesperson. We provide clear descriptions of these tools and robust controls so people can turn them on or off and delete their histories at any time. But people aren't buying that, and in fact, some lawmakers are pursuing this as well. But wow, that's kind of a big deal, don't you think?
Yeah, and again, it's not in Google's financial interests to make it easy for you to take control of your own stored history. They're gonna throw it in a disused lavatory behind a cabinet behind a door that says "Beware of the Leopard" because they like that data. They like keeping that data. They like selling that data. They like using that data to sell you things. And they'll give you something to click to make you happy, but really they like it.
Isn't it enough that I bought the damn phone? You know, I mean, it's a huge amount of money. And I also, I came up with a theory over the last week. Back in the old days, I don't want to keep saying it's back in the old days because I'll turn into one of those people. But back in the old days, when you got angry at things, you could slam them down like a phone. And if I get angry at something, excuse me, on my phone, then I can't slam that down, or I have to invest another $700 in another phone. And I think what's happening today is that people are being very careful with the way they express themselves physically. They no longer smash things or kick things. Because they're expensive. And you know, if you hit something the wrong way, it's going to break, and you got to pay all this money. So they're bottling all this rage up inside them, and it comes out in unhealthy ways. I think we need to bring back phones that you could slam down on the receiver, you know, slam down on the switch hook, and maybe we'll be more mentally healthy.
And those old phones were robust as hell, too, weren't they?
I still have
a nice, big, heavy piece of equipment. You could slam it down satisfyingly, you know, goodbye, slam. And you'll see it in old movies, TV shows, whatever. And those of you who weren't around to experience that in real life, you're missing out.
I am not ashamed to admit that I have a couple of those phones in various places around my house. And when I get upset at something, either on my computer or on my digital, cellular phone, I go into that room and I slam that phone, even though that phone did nothing to me. And boy, it does feel good. It really does feel good.
Especially when you get a little bit of the mechanical bell sound when you slam it hard enough.
Try it out, kids. If you haven't done it, go to a garage sale, get one of these old rotary phones that made by the Bell Company. And yeah, you can have the time of your life. Okay, speaking of the time of your life, are you guys all ready for the ATM cash out scheme that apparently all hackers know about and is coming up really, really soon? Yeah, the FBI is warning banks about this fraud scheme. It's called an ATM cash out. Now, how this works, for those of you who don't know, attackers typically compromise a bank or payment card processor with malware. They disable fraud controls, and then they start withdrawing large sums of money, sometimes millions of dollars, with cloned bank cards. Now, the FBI reportedly sent an alert to banks last week. The FBI has obtained unspecified reporting indicating cyber criminals are planning to conduct a global automated teller machine cash out scheme in the coming days, likely associated with an unknown card issuer breach and commonly referred to as an unlimited operation. So friends, if you're a part of this, best hurry up, get up early in the morning. It's an all day affair, and I guess cash out as much as you can. It's great how they know in advance that something like this is going to be happening. And wow, that's your bank security for you right there.
One thing that's interesting, I think we've covered these style of compromises in the past, is that the people who are actually executing this with the clone cards are probably going to be the ones that are rounded up first. So they're the worker bees doing all of the withdrawing, but they're going to be the ones on the ground dealing with the consequences of this, depending on how it's structured and arranged. So I would not actually personally be participating in this behalf of someone else, because they're not
loss.
Taking the risk.
The rest of us are going to be piling up cash and trying to sort it out later. Yeah, but it's crazy. That's what people think hackers do. that we all go out to the ATMs and just, collect. That's, yeah, you know, hackers can figure it out, but criminals are the ones who actually steal money. It's a amazing concept, but it's true. Okay.
Yeah, I'd say, yeah, we have more an interest in, like, keeping our resources than doing something fleeting like this.
Yeah, complaining about technology and figuring out ways to break things and fix them again and make them better. That's pretty much what the hacker is all about.
Yeah,
I like being a hacker. I also like not going to jail for bank robbery. So,
But yeah. That's not the reason why you don't rob a bank. It's because it's wrong.
Well, there's that
too. You know it's wrong. It doesn't feel right when you do it. And not that I know that, but I'm pretty sure it wouldn't feel right.
But it shouldn't be that we're gobsmacked the criminals are using technology in, what, 2018? I mean, it's innovative, yes. It's interesting and, you know, exciting and, yeah, maybe even a little more boring, less like Butch Cassidy or whatever, you know, like a train robber style. But it should not surprise us that the tools and techniques that hackers were sort of onto first or, you know, aware of how those systems work and how to exploit them, it should just not be a wonder that, crime is going to advance into the 21st century as well.
But in the news, the instant a criminal uses some sort of technology in the commission of their crime, then they're labeled a hacker. It's like if everyone who used a car in a crime was labeled a mechanic. It's fascinating.
You know, we've been having this conversation since the 80s, and I don't think we're ever going to progress past it. Not through fault of ours, but it's just the way the media and the way basically people understand this kind of thing. But here's something on the subject of bank security or bank insecurity. I was dealing with an issue over the past week involving, after every conference, a ton of bills that have to be paid. It's inevitable. And credit cards get maxed out. And we had a credit card that was completely maxed out that we needed to unmax. And we did, you know, made a hefty payment. Yet the week afterwards, sales were still being declined. Charges to that credit card were still being declined. So I called up the credit card company. I said, "Hey, what's up? You know, we paid you." And said, "Oh yeah, we don't have confirmation that this was paid." And I'm like, "Oh my God, we don't have enough to pay this." All kinds of nightmare scenarios. So I had to access my bank's records, and sure enough, a week earlier it was paid. So I called them back, and I said, "Okay, well, we need to get verification from the bank that it was paid, even though." Right there, there's a record of it that it was paid. They need to talk to the bank. So they basically made a three-way call to the bank, and I had to enter information. I think it was Social Security information or something to get access to the account. And then with the representative sitting on the phone, the automated recording read off the balance and all kinds of other options. And eventually, they wound up talking to a representative from the bank. So I had two representatives talking to each other about our account, and all kinds of information was being passed around, which really I don't think should have been passed around. And that is considered normal. You call a bank and you say you're calling from a credit card company and you have the customer on the line. All the usual questions they ask you, such as, "Okay, I'm going to give you a list of three streets. Which one did you grow up on?" And those are always fun. Always seem to be the same question too. Instead of doing that, they just basically believe them, and all this information is passed along. And the second that they were able to verify that the charge was paid, everything was okay. And again, in the other direction, you know, you could have easily pretended you were a representative saying just that, and the credit card company would have believed you. So, yeah, we have a long way to go security-wise for things like this. Rob?
Yeah, and credit cards have been a mainstream thing for some like 40 years now. We've had time to figure this out, and we've had time to move beyond this easily exploitable way of doing things that people were social engineering comfortably, you know, in decades past.
You know, like I said, it's the same conversation we've been having since the 80s. I look at articles that we print in the magazine, and basically, you know, people are talking about now it's Internet of Things. Devices that have default passwords, and you know, botnets and things are formed because of that. Because default passwords are used, and it's relatively simple. The same lessons aren't being learned, and it's really incredible. So yeah, that's a little bit of what's been going on. Now, Voltaire, you were at a big hacker conference that took place over the weekend, DEF CON.
Yeah, you might have heard of it.
It's 10 times bigger than HOPE, and boy, I can't even imagine what that must be like. But how was it?
It was a lot of fun. DEF CON kind of has, among like activist circles, has like a notorious reputation for being like kind of bro-y or,
Bro-y, that's the word?
Yeah, okay. Like people drinking too much alcohol, more of like infosec than hacker.
Well, it is in Vegas.
Yeah.
You gotta keep that in mind.
I think, because it's so large, as you mentioned, there are lots of, there's like many conferences within a conference. So like some are like more alcohol focused than people are not just aware that there are like other breakout conferences that are like, I went to Crypto and Privacy Village, which I especially liked. That had like the most hope like feel to it.
Uh-huh.
So I really like that. And
yeah, if you had to compare, other than being 10 times bigger than us, I would say they're more security focused. They're more focused on exploits and things like that. And we have, I guess we're more of a kind of an activist direction. And that's probably why we had the problems we had. With alt-right infiltration and various other unpleasantness, and also challenges that we have to tackle. But I know I heard some reports about things that were happening at DEF CON that were a challenge of a completely different nature, also related to our changing society. And in this particular case, whereas I think with HOPE we can do a better job, I don't really think there's anything they can do. I don't think they can be faulted for anything that happened here. It's basically hotel policy now in Vegas seems to allow for random searches.
It's not hotel policy in Vegas writ large. It's the hotel policy of these specific hotels of the ones that are hosting it.
This has something to do with the guy who went on a rampage and was shooting people in Vegas last year.
Nominally, yes. It's basically that. The gist of the policy is that now if you reject room service and you put do not disturb sign up for too many days, they'll have they'll force somebody to send in the security and like take a look around. And the official so this isn't a new law, it's just their policy. And their official policy is like they have a security guard go in and look around to see if you have any guns or anything, but they're not allowed to touch your stuff, and they're supposed to like identify themselves. But that in a lot of the reported cases, they broke those rules. They didn't identify themselves, so it could have obviously been somebody social engineering their way into it, and they also touch people's stuff and like start looking through their belongings.
Because if you go into a hacker's room, you're going to see things that are interesting,
exactly,
and possibly suspicious, and hackers are the people that would object more than anybody to random searches and having their privacy invaded.
Yeah. And I think the only solution really is to take for them to take their business if they can. DEF CON organizers have announced that they're going to go and like basically try and negotiate and get this policy changed for them. But the problem is like they have the only way to stop this is to take their business elsewhere, which is difficult because there's so much concentration in the market. The four hotels surrounding the Caesars are all owned by the same company, so it's like,
wow.
I saw people on Twitter saying like, oh well, if you don't like the policy, just like stay at a different hotel. It's like, yeah, but
you're mocking people on Twitter now. Wow.
Okay. Yes,
I never thought I'd see
mocking mocking people on Twitter on the radio.
Uh-huh.
But the problem with that is like, because Vegas is such a maze, like any hotel within a 20-minute walking distance is, I'm only exaggerating slightly, but any hotel within a 15-minute walking distance, it's owned by the same corporate outlet. So like you don't have a choice.
How did that happen? How did all the hotels wind up being owned by the same people?
Capitalism.
Wow. When you have 25,000 hackers, I know this from experience, because I've seen it happen with 3,000 hackers in the Netherlands and Germany. Yeah. Villages can be built. And I think I know this is silly, but you just go out into the desert and you build a city. You build a hotel of your own, and I don't know. I know that's not going to happen.
That's how Vegas started with the mafia.
That is how, okay, well, we don't know that. But the thing is, when you have that number of people, when you have that kind of publicity, you can affect change.
Oh, yeah,
definitely. And we totally stand behind whatever change they decide to make as a result of this. Because this is, it's not just hackers being affected, it's everybody being affected. I mean, the guy went nuts and killed a bunch of people. And nobody knows why to this day, so much for your mental health screening. And the way they decide to deal with that problem is to invade people's privacy for completely unrelated reasons and not do anything about actual guns. It's nonsense.
One thing I noticed following what was going on Twitter is that, hackers being hackers, somebody started circulating the code to dial on your hotel room phone to flag your room in the system as having had their room service already.
Is there a code for that? Why? Why do they even have that?
Apparently it was a thing, and so it got out.
So if the people that do the room service could just dial it in while they're in, when they finish a room. It makes it easier for them.
Wow. What if you know, you just like did like a long-term rental of a place? You sort of have like your own apartment complex, and they kind of just rent it out on their own terms for, you know, a weekend or a week or something like that. I don't know. There's all kinds of creative possible solutions.
Yeah, I would just reiterate or elaborate on what you were saying about access to other venues. I think like a motel probably wouldn't, but because these events are at a resort, like, you know, a highway motel is not going to be that concerned if you're saying do not disturb. But a resort like this, accommodating an event like this, especially given the proximity to the Mandalay Bay event or incident, is a concern. And I think hospitality, like you said, in general across the industry is definitely a lot more vigilant with this kind of stuff, especially like large amounts of luggage. I remember seeing some notices. I won't really elaborate very much more. I mean, it doesn't matter, but you know, we have access to some of the staff areas, and there were definitely notices for the hotel about large suitcases, that same kind of issue. But as far as how they implemented it and enforced it, we didn't have anything like that where rooms were being searched or anything, not that we're aware of. But I think maybe that's just a distinction of the like sort of stratification of the industry, and again the proximity in Vegas, that seems to be understandable, perhaps not reasonable, but understandable.
Again, like what we were talking about before with everybody going to the cloud, we cannot let this be normalized. We cannot let this be something that, that's just the price of living in a free society, because it's not a free society when you do things like this, and we need to stand together and make sure this does not become the norm, and hopefully we'll have more updates on that. We have phone calls to get to. Actually, we don't have any yet because I haven't given the phone number out. 347-335-0818 is our telephone number. Yes, 347 is the area code. 335-0818. Someone said we were going to install all kinds of new phone lines here. I don't see them yet, but you noticed a box or something, Kyle?
I don't know if it's new. It's like a panel in the wall here.
That sounds pretty solid to me.
It's locked though. I couldn't actually open it. I'll have to get some picks or something. But
yeah,
no,
of course.
I would never do that.
You don't have picks on you right now?
We're
hackers, for God's sake.
Actually, I might actually have some somewhere, but not in my hand.
All right.
And I would never pick a lock at the radio station. I can't believe you even suggested that. I mind the rules.
All right. Well, I don't know how we got into the building then.
And policies of WBA.
People know not to let us in. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
Pretty good. Glad to hear you. So you guys were talking earlier about what can be done with the general public and education on, well, how do we solve this stuff, the software, the service and all that?
Yes.
In my job, I have occasion to interact with the general public quite a bit with respect to their personal tech. And I'm sad to say, the vast majority of them, at least what they express, they don't seem to care.
You're right.
You know, and it's sad, but I meet a lot of people who would rather have free Gmail and decline full disk encryption, you know, because they're worried about forgetting their passwords or, you know, therefore lose their decryption key. And it's, I don't know. And when I hear you guys talk about this stuff, I sometimes wonder if you guys ever have occasion to talk with the general public about this stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And in our own heads, I think we have the conversation too. Hey, I've got nothing to hide. Is it really that much of a sacrifice, you know? And what a hassle it is to encrypt everything and to maintain all these privacy standards. I mean, Kyle, you set up SecureDrop for us at 2600, which, by the way, folks, we have SecureDrop at 2600. So if you have something to leak, like tax returns or audio files of people saying things, go to our SecureDrop page at 2600.com or go to the list at SecureDrop. You know, for that, to set that up, the levels of privacy that you need, encryption, all kinds of things like that, it would drive the average person nuts to set it up, which, you know, is probably why most people don't do that. But, you know, I think the solution to this is to make a certain level of privacy, encryption, what have you, the default, and make it simple to implement. Of course, this is something that the government would never support.
Sure.
Another aspect for us is just to be able to speak about it, because we don't want to be insulated. We don't want to just talk to hackers who are all crazy about their cryptography and privacy, and they're all, you know, on point with it. The average person isn't, like you said, and I think that's absolutely, it's critical to understand, because if we, you know, we feel it, we get insulated sometimes, and we, every now and then, I use the example, are introduced to people who are still afraid of hackers, and for us, we only, you know, having spent so much time talking about hacking and that kind of thing, when we go to Maker Faire, we go to an event and evangelize and talk about hacking to people, it's critical to make those introductions and say, well, yeah, that's partly what is said about us, but we're really into this, and that's why asking the question and having your feedback is really brilliant for us, because it's real, it's authentic.
They're afraid of us because we're about to clear out their bank accounts, you know, and everybody knows it.
I agree with your point, Emmanuel, that like the best solution to this is making it easier to use privacy tools, and also making these big services requiring them to have secure policies. But I don't think that can only happen through, like I don't agree with your like defeatism about like politics, that it's always going to be that the government is never going to change this. Like, look at things like, even though the national government right now is not that great, we in like Europe, they just passed the GDPR, which
pick a country that gets it.
California just, it's not just countrywide, it's like local initiatives. California just passed a law requiring a pro privacy law, which is pretty good.
Latvia.
Okay. All right.
Care to expand on that?
I don't know. Aren't they voting online now?
That's supposed to be good?
I don't know. I'm not saying it's good.
Estonia,
I'm saying
Estonia, but that's bad.
Is it Estonia? Yeah. Okay. Latvia and Estonia. Okay.
No, but I think that like their color is expressing a point about privacy. A sense of privacy defeatism, which is understandable. But I think we should also not have a sense of government or politics defeatism either.
Well, there's a certain ironic, it's a little ironic, because we're all used to talking about this. We're comfortable talking about this. We like talking about this. So the tools to keep our stuff private, you know, TrueCrypt and so on, SecureDrop, you mentioned, Emmanuel, we're used to using these tools. We're comfortable using them. And yet, they're I don't know, it would be great if a player emerged to normalize encryption.
Absolutely.
You know, to make it so that it's not just for the hackers, right?
And including the like the processes and procedures in place, that workflow as a habit for everybody, just like we work in our home office or with machines in general. You know, having that be ingrained as a part of how you use these tools.
I think the thing that we need to keep in mind, it doesn't have to be completely perfect in every way, because there's always going to be something that we're not satisfied with. And I think we're always holding out for something that has this particular level of security, et cetera, et cetera. As long as it's improved, as long as it's significantly better than what we have right now, which is virtually no security, that is a step, and I think we need to take that step before we take the next step. It's kind of like politics, because you know, you need to take a step before you move in a good direction. You can't just get there in one step.
Well, maybe another aspect of this is perhaps not to just immediately say no to the cloud, and maybe that's ultimately the answer, no to the cloud, but maybe there's more traction to be gained from normalizing questioning the cloud, you know, questioning how does this company store my information? If they say it's secure, what's their track record been with situations in the past?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of encryption do they use? Is my connection to them encrypted? Who has the keys? So on and so forth. Maybe arm people with, well, the comfort with that has to exist before they can start asking those questions. I wonder if saying no to the cloud by policy, and there's this personal policy, I mean, is necessarily the most effective way to get people on board. I mean, it's here.
Well, I'm not saying say no to the cloud, because the cloud is very useful for a number of things, but at least know what you're getting into.
Right. And normalize the questioning rather than...
Yes.
You know?
I like that. Normalize the questioning. That should be our motto.
Well, there you go.
All right.
You can print it.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for being on the air.
Take care. Good call there.
Yeah, it was really good. I just thought maybe we need a cloud rating system.
That would be something, I guess. Let's get another call, 347-335-0818. We only have a couple of minutes left, and we'd like to hear from as many people as possible. And I think we only have the one phone line still. So if we have more phone lines, they have not yet been hooked up, either that or only one person called in. But I think that's the case. I think we only have the one.
I saw different lights than usual. It looks like it's improving or at least changing.
Yeah, they might change the color of the lights, but that's about it.
Well, it was on one side. I think it's been on the other before.
Yeah, but they move it around sometimes. 347-335-0818. You can be the lucky person to get through to that one phone line until we get more. We used to have 12 phone lines. In fact, we still do on this phone here, but only that one works. Let me read a letter. We're getting more letters than ever before, which is awesome. I guess people have strong feelings about the things we've been talking about. Dear Off the Hook folks, I wasn't able to come to Hope this year. Just learned about the MAGA trolling. I listened to the post-conference Off the Hook as well and wanted to tell you I support the slow and contemplative way you're handling it and totally love that you can say the bastards got the better of you this time. Tyranny is easy. Free speech and open societies are hard. And it was great to hear Bernie S. on the radio again. Thanks, RH, for that that email. You can send your email to oth@2600.com. Here's another Dear Off the Hook. This is in relation to last week's show. We had a pretty spirited discussion about Alex Jones. Freedom of speech has its limitations. For instance, you cannot call fire in a crowded theater. What Alex Jones... Actually, can we just put a big asterisk there? Because nobody ever gets this. If the theater is on fire, you can yell fire in the crowded... I just want people to understand that. You know, I'm sitting in a theater, it's burning, but I'm not allowed to say fire. No, in that particular situation, you are. No one ever pens that. It's always bugged me. Anyway, yeah. What Alex Jones did to parents of the children murdered at Sandy Hook falls into that category. He declared the whole episode to be staged by the U.S. government to limit the right to carry firearms. After his announcements, his supporters made life for parents of the children so miserable that many of them, including Mr. Posner, the father of one of the murdered children, had to leave Sandy Hook. They were attacked and threatened by phone and by mail. Mr. Jones also attacked a pizza place in Washington, accusing them of torturing children. And those crazy accusations caused a man to arm himself with a gun with the intention of shooting the owner and liberating the children. Thank you, Cass, for your insights on that. Yes. You know, there are situations where, calls to violence and spreading falsehoods that hurt people, such as Holocaust denial and things like that, that's you have to draw the line someplace. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up, please. Nobody there. Okay, well, somebody called in, so I'm going to hang up, and hopefully somebody else will call in who is speaking. 347-335-0818. I can read another letter, or Rob, you have something?
Yeah, the thing I wanted to say about the Alex Jones thing is it's not censorship if it's a private entity saying you can't use our service. Like, I have a blog, and if someone leaves a comment I don't like, I'm allowed to delete it because it's my venue.
It still is censorship. It's just not a First Amendment violation.
That's exactly what
although
I
would
say,
argue that.
If we edit an article in 2600, is that censorship then? We're cutting out a word.
Yes, it's censorship, but it's not as bad because
it's not violating.
I don't think editing
speech
is censorship. Yeah, I think it's clarity.
What if we throw a MAGA hat out of a conference?
You know what? I'm cutting you off. Okay. There. I guess it is censorship in a way. Let's take another phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Good evening. Just wondering, has your community been following the Unity for J movement? That's to rally in support of Julian Assange not being extracted from the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
Well, we've been taking that position for years now, so I'm not right. Sure what's changed. Other than what he's doing, I don't think much has changed.
Well, there's a movement online under Unity for J, and they're trying to do a lot of spreading of the word and mobilizing the community in all types of different activities and support. And they've been having these marathon sessions where they will, vigils is what they're calling them. They've had about three or four so far, and they're all accessible under Unity for J, but I'm trying to help in my small way by spreading the word.
Okay, and can you just give out the website again?
Unity for J And I would imagine just a Google search will pull that up. And as I say, there are all kind of vigils that you can go on YouTube, and they've had 10 and 24 and 15-hour vigils, and all types of people, including Kim.com, who's amazing, have come on and spoken out for hours and hours, and they've had these marathon vigils, and it's been very, very, very informative and, you know, very energizing.
Okay, well, thanks, thanks for giving out that information, and hopefully people will be aware of it. Thanks
for calling. Thank you.
You know, I didn't want to get into an argument on the air about this, but I know, Voltaire, you have something to say about this as well. But I do know that Barrett Brown was kicked out of the Courage Foundation because he criticized Julian Assange. And Kim.com is one of these pro-Trump people. And, I just go on for a long, long time about the various things that bother me about that.
Yeah, but I agree with you on those points, but I think that, Julie, we should be fighting against
And that has never changed. That's never been the of course.
Well, there are some people that take that line, and we should be.
Those people are wrong.
Exactly, we should be articulating a stronger middle ground where free speech without
to be kicked out because you criticize somebody, which is what Barrett Brown did to Julian Assange. That's wrong. That is as wrong as anything. And this is something that we also need to speak up about. You can agree on one thing and disagree on another, and I think that's kind of our overall theme.
At least he didn't take a security clearance.
We don't know that yet. And in fact, I haven't checked on you guys yet. You might have lost yours.
Oh, darn.
For saying the things you said. Okay, hey, we're out of time. Write to us, oth@2600.com. And we will hopefully see you back again next week. Good night. The sky of your love keeps me breathless. I can't help thinking we could have had it.
On Sunday, August 19th at 11 p.m., Shug in My Bowl presents multidimensional bassist and composer Jamaluddin Tukuma. Join us as we discuss parts of Jamaluddin Tukuma's career and discuss what's happening in the red carpet room. That's Sunday, August 19th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Today is August the 15th, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, my colleague is Joe King, and podcast of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, also on prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM, 99.5 on the radio, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. 25 Android smartphones from well-known brands come with severe vulnerabilities pre-installed. It's one thing to discover you've installed malware on your phone while sideloading an app that you thought it was safe to use. And it's quite another to find out that your phone was shipped with preloaded vulnerabilities that would allow third parties to spy on you. Yes, it does happen. What's more disturbing is that some of the well-known Android vendors out there include preloaded security issues. Researchers from CryptoWare discovered some 38 vulnerabilities in preloaded apps that reside in the firmware builds of 25 Android handsets, including 11 models that are sold in the United States. Here's a list of Android vendors affected, which includes Asus, Essential, LG, Nokia, Sony, and ZTE. For example, in the Asus Zenfone 3 Max, attackers could use a flawed pre-installed app to access system data and Wi-Fi passwords. It's also possible to execute code through a wireless connection. The Essential phone, meanwhile, comes with a pre-installed app that would allow any app to wipe all user data via factory reset. The LG G6 packs a bunch of issues itself, including a vulnerability that can lock a user out of their phone and force the user to do a factory reset in recovery mode. The same phone can be used to gain the kernel log. The Nokia 6 and the Sony Xperia L1 comes with issues that will allow attackers to capture screenshots quietly. The ZTE Z Max Pro allow hackers to steal text messages and even edit or send them without your knowledge. The security researchers have notified all manufacturers as well as Google Android vendors, including Asus, Essential, and LG have either deployed fixes or will do it. Meanwhile, Google explained that the issues do not affect the Android operating systems, but they do affect the third-party code and application on devices. Google is working with CryptoWare to address the issue. If you own one of the phones mentioned above, make sure you install the latest updates, and if you're worried about your data, contact the manufacturer for more information. And here's a word of advice if you're looking to buy a new phone. If you can afford it, try to buy the phone unlocked so that these vulnerable apps are not pre-installed on the phone. The problem of robocalling is getting worse. In April, robocall blocking service UMail estimated 3.4 billion such calls were made, 900 million more than the month over the same period in 2017. The FCC is taking steps to fix the influx of robo-spam, but thus far, it's only addressing part of the problem. If it's you on the receiving end of a seemingly never-ending barrage of, well, scam robocalls, a fix couldn't come soon enough. Some smartphone owners should get a respite from this issue thanks to Google. Google recently updated its Android phone app to automatically filter out calls it identifies as spam. The app will automatically send these calls straight to your voicemail without ringing your device. This means that if the caller decides to leave a voicemail, like the IRS is coming after you and you better act fast, well, you'll still receive it. However, your day won't be interrupted by your phone ringing or vibrating, and that's certainly a boon. If you're on an Android phone running Android 6.0 or later, you can turn this feature on by heading to the phone app, tapping the setting icon in the upper right, then selecting caller ID and spam, then toggle on filter spam calls. The latest update is an upgrade over Google's previous efforts at sorting spam. Until now, its phone app has been able to identify suspected spam calls via caller ID. When one of these known numbers called your number, your phone would ring, but the screen would turn red with the words suspected spam caller. The screen also showed a reminder that you could swipe downward to reject the call. The new call filtering feature is an extension of this work, and according to Google, it's one of the Android phone app most popular features. It was a natural next step to improve the experience even further to reduce the distraction and hassle receiving a spam call. Unfortunately, stopping one of the latest trends in spam and robocalling, neighbor spoofing, is still a work in progress. Neighbor spoofing happens when a caller modifies what displays on caller ID, making a phone call, well, appear local. The recipient is more likely to answer since the call looks like it could be from a neighbor, a colleague, or an area business. These calls are more difficult to identify since they look like they could originate from a legitimate source rather than a previously reported spam phone number. Still, Google's recent moves are more than what's being done on competing operating systems. On iOS, your only option for filtering and identifying spam phone callers is to use a third-party app. While it's not necessarily difficult to set up an app like Truecaller, which is free, or Robocaller, which costs about $250 a month, it is an extra hassle and potentially an extra expense, depending on which app you download. Your other alternative is to use a service like T-Mobile's Scam ID and Scam Block, which is free, or Verizon's Caller Name ID, which is about $3 a month, to help filter and identify robocalls on your carrier's end. Some phone makers, such as Samsung, also offer built-in features for identifying blocking spam calls. Even with tools like these in place, defeating spam and robocalls feel like an uphill battle. While consumers are crying against the practice, major corporations such as SiriusXM, Capital One, and others are lobbying the administration to slacken its robocall policies. Proposed changes would mean the consumer would have no legal right to demand these kind of incessant calls stop. But as the FCC continues to debate the issue of robocalls and spam, consumers have at least a few options for stemming the flow. And just to let everyone know, robocalls are not banned if they are from nonprofits or, of course, your favorite friend, the politician. Google has issued a new rule for Android phones. Two notches? Okay. Three notches? Uh-uh. Notches are a fixture on today's smartphones. Rather than a thick black bar across the top and bottom of a device, phone makers have opted to extend the screen as high as possible to maximize real estate. But since we still have cameras and other sensors on the front of the device, a cutout, a notch, that's what they're calling it, typically needs to jut downwards into the display. Apple's iPhone X, while not the first to feature the design, was the one that mainstreamed it. There are now 16-notch Android devices available from 11 manufacturers. This week, Google finally published its guidelines on the controversial smartphone element, and it included a curious direction. Google set a few guidelines for how phone makers should implement notches on Android handsets. While we've only seen single cutout phones so far, Android is putting the kibosh on devices that plan to have more than two notches. Three is one notch too many. Apparently, Google also set stipulations that these notches can only be positioned on the top and bottom of the device screen and that there can only be one cutout per short edge of the device. Google said the cutout must not negatively affect apps. Well, that's for Android phones. Will Apple come up with similar design requirement? They can do anything they want. They design the iPhone, and they'll design it the way they want it. The top pay TV providers now account for about 92 million subscribers, with the top six cable companies having 48 million video subscribers. Satellite TV services have 31 million subscribers, and the top telephone companies about 9 million subscribers. And the top internet-delivered pay TV services accounts for about 4 million subscribers. Well, this was just recently released. The top six cable companies lost about 285,000 video subscribers in the first quarter of this year, compared to a loss of 115,000 subscribers last year. The top telephone providers lost